Oregon is halfway through its fall camp. There's some hype, some red flags, and could there be some major snubs on Oregon's roster?
Welcome into the Autzen Audibles podcast. I'm Matt Preem, Eric Scopel on the show as always, diving into another edition of the Autzen Audibles podcast during fall camp, mind you. We are, I don't know, day 12 into fall camp, practice 12. Are we going into practice 13, Eric? We're at the point where the every day blends into one day.
We're at the day where I've lost count of the days. So yes. I'm not going to correct you on whether or not it's day 12 or 13, but we're at that point. We're getting close to the end of camp.
And that means as we get closer and closer to the end of fall camp, we're diving into kind of position battles. We're looking at some parts of opportunities that are presenting itself. We're looking at opportunities that guys have a lot on the line going into the next couple of weeks as the team puts its finishing touches on fall camp, gets itself in preparation for its season opener against Boise State. There's a handful of jobs all the way around both sides of the football that are up for grabs. But right now, Eric, like, I don't really know. Obviously, Dante Moore is solidified, right? Like, Kowakai, I think Oregon's quarterback coach, kind of threw out kind of a comment of kind of like, these guys still have to compete, and it's still, you know, everyone's still pushing. But, you know, Dan Lanning said kind of the same thing, like, hey, we haven't really solidified any position yet. While we think Dante Moore is going to be the starter, like, he still has to compete, and if he doesn't, you know, he loses his job. He didn't say that word directly, but that's kind of what he was leading us to. But fair to say, breaking news here: Dante Moore will be the starting quarterback for the Ducks in 2026. Who behind Dante Moore gets that number two job is up in the air. And Eric, that answer changes because of the NCAA's 5-for-5 ruling as well. Because remember, when Dylan Raiola first transferred to Oregon, the narrative, the intent, the purpose for 2026 for him was to sit, develop, redshirt, sit back a little bit. And so we kind of looked at it as like, hey, it's probably like a two-man job. Now it's a legit opportunity for Dylan or for somebody else to just outright win the job, because you no longer can redshirt in college athletics.
Yeah, and we should note that's reflected in the new roster that was posted yesterday, which is worth looking at. Heights and weights are available. We'll touch on some of those in here. But like, from now on, and this is, I think, what we heard from Oregon, you know, employees, is kind of like the NCAA mandated way to represent players is freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, fifth year being, you know, fifth year senior, a player with an extra year of eligibility. And so you look at Raiola, you look at Dante Moore, they're juniors and seniors on the roster, but there's no RS next to anybody on this roster. Red shirts don't exist anymore. I think that's kind of an interesting dynamic. And to your point, Matt, if we don't get access to practice, we can check that one off the list of things we'll say during this show, and maybe that'll be the last time, maybe it won't, we'll see. But I think that the thing that stands out coming out of the first scrimmage, which we're going to talk about a little bit more in depth later in the show, but certainly from interviews with Kowakai, Dante Moore, and then even Dan Lanning, where he was asked a little bit more specifically about some of these guys, is it feels, at least from their perspective, they have four guys capable of going out and leading them to victories. We know about Dante Moore. He just led Oregon to a 13-win season. You assume Dylan Raiola would be capable of doing that based upon the fact that he had success at Nebraska. And we can talk about some of the stuff we've heard there. I thought, to me, you know, I'll mention Brock Thomas. I don't want to gloss over him. He does get glossed over by the fan base, but most experienced guy, been in the program the longest time. But to me, the one that really jumped out was just the Akili Smith Jr. development that Koa mentioned. 6'5", 245, like that's just a big kid.
It's a big quarterback.
And the fact that it sounds like he's playing the position the way that they want him to, right? Like, I think in the past there was a sense that he was just relying on this undeniable physical talent, right? The big arm, the big body, the ability to just, you know, huck it down the field, kind of unlike anybody on this team. but now it sounds like he's going through progressions. He's figured out a way, according to Koekkai, to really prepare himself with this, with the playbook of, he's got a whiteboard in his guest room, which, by the way, is funny hearing that a college has a guest room. Cause I'm going, like, when I was, we had a common area because we had four of my friends, we each had bedrooms, and then we had one that, I don't know, 15 by 15 foot common area that we shared. But he has his own guest room, apparently, that has a whiteboard in it, that he's drawing up the plays, the installs every day. And it really sounds like that's paying off. Right. And, you know, I think we'd always kind of looked at this as like, sure, Dylan's the most talented number two on this roster, right? He might be the most talented player on the roster from a quarterback perspective. You could make the case. I don't know if I would, but you could certainly say that. But and Brock's the most experienced, so it'll probably be a Dylan versus Brock battle to be the number two. And I still probably anticipate one of those guys will be the first quarterback not named Dante Moore to see the field this year. It really does feel like KJ's coming. Like that's the sense you're getting from the staff. And I thought it was kind of notable too, Matt, when I asked Dante, just like, okay, what were your thoughts from the scrimmage, but also just of camp, of some of the backups? And, you know, he gave his, like, everyone's progressing, it's a good room. But he also really shouted out KJ himself, right? Of just like, there's been some progress. He's taking a step. Like, it's impressed him. It's clearly caught his eye. And so I think this, you can kind of talk about this legitimately as a three-player battle for the number two job. And I think the thing that's also interesting, Matt, and you can kind of break down a little bit of this because I know you're writing about it, but the process to get to who the number two is kind of interesting. And it might not be a thing where it's cut and dry. We named Dylan Raiola as the number two quarterback on September 5th for the Boise State game. And that's the case all the way throughout the season. It really sounds like this could be a thing that changes somewhat frequently, depending upon how this all, like, kind of depending on who deserves it. And also, it won't be just a decision made by the quarterback's coach, which I thought was sort of interesting to hear.
Yeah, we talked to Koekkai and also Lanning about that process of, because remember, the last couple of years, they've kind of had to toe that tightrope of finding last year, Austin Novosad and Brock Thomas kind of shared the role until Brock kind of just won it outright midway through the season. The year before that, Novosad and Dante Moore kind of shared it as they were trying to redshirt Dante Moore's eligibility. And then the year before that, Novosad redshirted, and they were trying to, you know, keep him under that four-game threshold but play him a lot. So we've seen Oregon under Lanning kind of do this tightrope of, they don't really have like a bona fide set backup.
True.
And because they're trying to redshirt guys, and they're trying to play the four-game game guarantee thing, and this year it's different, where the redshirt's now eliminated. They don't have to worry about, well, if we only play Dylan Raiola six snaps in this game, is it really worth doing that? And so now it becomes, who's going to be the outright? Do they do an outright? I don't know. I guess maybe that's another question that we should ask, is it best for them to pick a guy and say, we think he's probably the most likely to be the starter in 2027, let's roll with him as the primary backup, and then if there's other opportunities, we'll go down the list. Or do they flip-flop like they've done the last couple of years? But remember, under Dillingham in 2022 and then under Will Stein in 23, 24, 25, Stein and Dillingham were a QB coach. They were also the offensive coordinator. They had total autonomy of the offense. They got to dictate what the offense did. Now, granted, Lanning certainly is the boss and could override whatnot, but I don't think that really probably ever happened. And if it did, they will never let the public into that world and that lens to see that play out. This year, it's a little different. The dynamics are different. Drew Merringer is the offensive coordinator, so he technically has final say, but he's not the position coach. He's not the guy that's in the room. At least we know, leading the QB breakdowns of technique and work and all of that. That's Koekkai, Oregon's quarterback coach. And Koa Kai said it's a collaborative effort, how he described it. Working with Drew Maringer, working with Jay Johnson, who's one of the assistant quarterback coaches in the room, also his input, and then, of course, he said Lanning's input because he's got final say. We asked Lanning about that process, what that's like. Didn't really want to give us too much around it, but did kind of like, hey, everyone's competing. Everyone's going to have to work. We're going to take the guy that's just the most consistent, or I guess in this case, the second most consistent quarterback of the group, and we'll roll with that. But who gets final say is still up for grabs. I think it's probably going to be I don't think there's like an internal struggle here, but I bet you it's going to be a collaborative effort, like to use Koa's words, of he probably has an idea, runs it by Drew. Drew's probably going to just kind of rubber stamp it. Like, okay, yep, trust you, here we go. Unless it's just drastically different than what they anticipate.
Let's put on a predictive cap for a second here, sure. Matt. Has anything we've heard in the past week changed the way we're looking at this backup battle? And who do we expect to see the field? And frankly, like, will it be Boise State? Will it be Oklahoma State? Will it ultimately be Portland State where we see a second quarterback come into the field? Because, again, I think Oregon will win comfortably its first two games. I think as the number two team in the country, they are clearly better than the opponents they're playing. But both those teams did receive votes in the coaches' polls and the AP's polls. So these are teams that are not total cupcakes, I don't think. And maybe Oregon will just flex and we'll see who the backup is earlier. But whenever we do see a second quarterback besides Dante take the field, like who do you think it is? Like, maybe we should just take a second to call our shots on this still.
I think this is going to be kind of a cop-out. I think they're going to share Brock Thomas and Dylan Raiola for the first couple weeks and give Brock Thomas an opportunity. This is, I guess, pull out the deep crystal ball here for a second. They are going to give Brock Thomas some opportunities. They're going to keep that competition battle brewing through the first quarter of the season between Dylan Raiola, just to push him, right? Like, you don't get to just show up and be the number two quarterback. You got to win it. You got to battle it out. You got to perform.
Sure.
I also think there's going to be an opportunity for Brock Thomas to get some film, and he's going to be a starting quarterback somewhere else in 2027. Not that he doesn't want to be at Oregon, but I just, I've seen this story so many times, and he's going to be a guy that I think, Koa said it, like, if he wanted to go in the portal, he'd have opportunities elsewhere as a scholarship player opposed to being a walk-on at Oregon. And so I think there's going to be a dual share for a little bit. Dylan Raiola will win it. And then we'll see Brock Thomas go and be a starting quarterback at a lower level school somewhere, whether that's FCS or the lowest level of group of five, somewhere, because athletes ultimately, they want to play, right? Like, so I think that's my crystal ball for what's going to happen. I think Brock Thomas will leave on his own terms. He'll leave in good graces with the staff. They'll be fully supportive of it. His players and teammates will be fully supportive, understanding. Love to have you, but we get it. Like, you want to go play, and here you go. So I think there's going to be an opportunity for him to get some film to show for the portal. And then I also think at some point Dylan Raiola will win the number two job and we'll get the majority of the snaps probably after September.
So your prediction is they are both on the field at the same time?
Yes, absolutely.
That's how we're going to – I didn't ask you who was going to be on first, and you said both, and so I'm trying to, like, maybe – I guess Drew's going to be really creative with that. I'll just, like, outright, I ultimately expect it will be Dylan who we see first. And again, like, I don't know – I kind of agree with Matt's assessment that I do think we're going to end up seeing multiple quarterbacks get an opportunity probably through the month of September into October. October is going to be the month, I think, frankly, where they can make some calls because, again, I expect to be 4-0 entering October. USC is not a game I anticipate the backups get in. And boy, if they do, that tells you a lot about where this team's at, because that's going to be a USC team that's probably top 10 by the time they play. I think USC opened at 14 or 15 in the AP poll that was released earlier this week. And I mentioned the Oklahoma State, Boise State thing, but I look at the month of October and they're hosting Northwestern, they're hosting Nebraska, they're hosting UCLA, and like those three teams were all bottom half Big Ten predicted teams. I think those are games that they're going to be pretty comfortable in. I think that's where maybe you get an assessment of it. But I do think Dylan ultimately is the number two. And I'm really curious to see, do we get any KJ this year? Or like when yeah.
when does he see the field?
Yeah, when with our own eyes do we get to kind of see what the staff is so excited about right now? Like, because, you know, it's one thing to talk about this in August, about all the progress he's made and the physical tools, which are so undeniable. You know, I mean, I remember seeing him when he was in high school, and I thought physically he resembled Justin Herbert, just in the height and the width and just kind of the way he carried himself. And he's listed at 6'5", 245 on the roster. That's pretty close to Justin. I know Justin's listed at 6'6 in the NFL, but like it's that same type of body type. He is so physically gifted. I just am expecting at some point we'll see him play. And I'm wondering if that might be earlier than we anticipate sometime this fall. And maybe it's just the Portland State game. Everybody gets in and that's the opportunity, but maybe it'll be another, I don't know. I'm really fascinated. Like I'm with you, Matt. Like I think ultimately Brock's probably not on this roster, whether it's, he's listed as a fifth year. I don't know if he has more eligibility to go play somewhere else, but regardless, I don't know if I expect him to be on this team in 27. And I think 27, it's a Raiola KJ competition. And I'm curious to see, frankly, like, does that competition really become one, or is it a case of they brought Raiola in with the plan? We'll talk about competition, quote unquote, but 27 is Dylan's year. So I'm honestly most interested in how KJ fits into all of this big picture, but also just this fall of like, do we get to see him very often?
Real quick before we move to the next topic, I don't know why Brock Thomas is a fifth year now on the roster, because he showed up as a freshman in 2023, which is his first year, redshirted that year. 2024, he was a redshirt freshman, and in 2025, he was a redshirt sophomore. So at most, he should be a true senior going into.
Yeah, this should be his fourth year. They did that wrong.
Unless he's like going to graduate or something, and that's how they're going to dictate, like, hey, he's an early graduate, and.
If that's the case, they've got to streamline this, because you can't say a guy's a fifth year when he's not actually in his fifth year. Like, yeah. I just call him a senior, and then if he moves on and isn't going to use his fifth year, great, that's what happens. But good job clarifying that, because I was looking at it going, it says he's a fifth year, but yeah, this is year four in the program, so I don't know why he's listed that way. Confusing.
Okay. Is the hype real, Eric, on Oregon's defensive line depth? I mean, obviously, we know that the top four guys, Mateo, Tatum, Bear, Amari, you could list them in any combination. You'd probably be right saying that's the best guy to the fourth guy. All four of them NFL dudes. But we talked about this at other positions, too, previously, walking out of press conferences. But it seems like the staff, the players, the peers, they are all in on the potential, the talent, the depth that they have. Mind you, they lost Terrence Green, they lost Ashton Porter, they lost Tione Gray, they lost Blake Purchase, they lost Jericho Johnson. You know, guys that all landed at Power Four schools and
some big time programs.
Some of them, Alabama, Notre Dame, like
straight up Ole Miss for Blake Purchase. Like these are big, yeah.
Like these are very legit dudes going to, assuming starting roles at playoff caliber programs, and yet we get the sense talking to everybody that I don't know if. No one's ever said this outright, but I don't think they're expecting much of a drop-off. Not to say, like, we didn't think those guys were good, but just we have so much talent that it's just going to be the next wave, kind of per se, from what the staff is and what the players are giving us out. Do we buy this, that there's that much talent in the second wave, third wave that Oregon has?
I think this has been the biggest – shift for me in, from an anticipation perspective. This is the group I'm most excited to watch now in the first couple of games. Not even the starters, just this group of younger players. There's a lot of hype in the spring, but you know, like I think for a long time it's been like this receiving group, some of these younger defensive backs, like there's just so much anticipation. And I'm sure when we get to those games, we'll be talking a lot about, oh my gosh, what is Jalen Lott's role on this team going to be? Oh, Naeem Offord's taking a big step. But the more we talk to people and the more we, I mean, and maybe I'm just a, you know, I'm kind of in the moment here because we got the heights and weights and the rosters and I'm looking at it going like, these are some big boys that we already knew had elite movement skills, but the fact that Matt Johnson is 319, Aiden Breland's 315, Tank Jones 301 pounds, excuse me, what? I didn't expect that. It's just kind of increased this. And then the way you heard Tony Tuioti, who's, I don't know, a top two or three interview on the staff for me in terms of what he shares and how open he is and his enthusiasm for the players in his room, it just took it to another level for me on Monday. I came out of that going like, man, I'm fascinated to see what this looks like. You know, I asked him, you know, what were his scrimmage takeaways? And he just basically ran through all the second unit guys and the names I just mentioned and was like, this guy's a dude, this guy's a dude. You know, I mentioned Elijah Rushing as a dude. I mean, the fact that DeAndre Robinson, who was a starter at North Carolina last year, was kind of like fourth billing in the way he ran it down. That doesn't necessarily mean that's like representative of the roster, right? Like that could have just been, you know, could have been alphabetical for all I know. Which I think technically it would have been Breland. Yeah, I think maybe that could be, we'll just say it was alphabetical. But my point is like the fact that he's like the fifth name mentioned in the backup line tells you a lot, I think, about what is developing here. And like, let's just stay on Tank Jones for a moment. I mean, I don't want to make too much out of this necessarily, but the fact that he's a true freshman who was listed at 240 out of high school, probably arrived closer to 260 from everything we've heard, and has just reshaped his body. But according to Tuioti, has just been wreaking havoc in practice. And Mateo in particular really shouted out the development. Like, I didn't necessarily know what to do with him. Five-star freshman kind of can kind of go either way, right? You even saw it last year. Like, Finney's a guy who emerges. Offord doesn't necessarily. DeCorian emerges. You know, some of these other players don't make big – aren't necessarily as incorporated. It feels like Tank Jones is coming, and it feels like he's playing this year, right? Like, it feels like that's where this is headed. So I'm saying, yes, the hype is real. I will also have to wait until we get through the month of September to have any sense of how real it is, but – I was posting on the message board yesterday with, you know, just kind of on this topic about, and by the way, go join the Duck Territory message board, the Duck Pond, to get our insights aside from the podcast, but of just what does this look like in 27 even, you know, not to get too far ahead, 26 hasn't even started, but every single one of those names has eligibility for 27. And it's really easy to get kind of concerned and, you know, go, oh man, they're going to lose Mateo. They're going to lose all these guys. And what's going to be the next wave? Like, I think the next wave is going to be really special. And I think you're already starting to kind of hear that from the staff this camp.
Yeah. I think that's like the perfect way to put it is the next wave is already going to be pretty special. And now we just might see it a little earlier.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. I think I'm probably buying the hype here. I think we've seen enough from a couple of these guys to feel like, okay, they're going to be serviceable isn't the right word, but they're going to be guys that you can count on to play dependable snaps on a limited basis. And those guys, I think that we can say that to are Aiden Breland, Matt Johnson, Nasir Wyatt, and DeAndre Robinson. Nasir, Johnson, and Breland all kind of did it in spurts last season, this year being the big name. He played in all 15 games for the Ducks. Breland played in 12, a couple snaps here and there. I think it's important to note that he just played a lot in such a lot of games, I should say, in a loaded unit where there were so many guys that could play. His snaps are probably significantly higher if you just took away a Tione Gray, right? Mm-hmm. Like, from the roster all in its entirety last season. His snaps go way up. Matt Johnson played in every single playoff game for Oregon, and I know it was just a handful of snaps per game, but he played. I think that, to me, is a sign that they knew right away he's going to be a dude. And then DeAndre Robinson was just a starter at North Carolina the previous season. So I have a hard time saying a starter at a lesser program is going to struggle to just even be a backup. Like, I know we saw Mekhi Hughes last season do that, but how many times has that happened at Oregon?
I mean, I don't expect it, but the possibility has crossed my mind that he just doesn't end up being very meaningful just because of what we're hearing. I mean, I mean, he might end up being the number three defensive tackle for all I know. But I'm just saying.
I think that's like a real possibility, but I think he's, regardless of if he's like the number one backup or the number three backup at D tackle, I think he's going to play. Whereas last year with Mekhi Hughes, like, he just didn't play. Like, it was very evident. Sorry, man. Like, you're so far down the list, we can't even get you in the game. And you're not, you're just, because you're not ready yet. Guys, I think, though, will take the jump, and that I think we're probably banking on for the hype to be real. Obviously, Tank Jones. I think Elijah Rushing is probably the next one. And then there's two other guys that I have on my list of, they're probably going to play. It's just going to be limited snaps. Blue Dantzler, the sophomore transfer from Oregon State. And then we've heard a lot about Dutch Horsick. Mm-hmm. And another true freshman, a guy that came from St. John Bosco, powerhouse program and one of the toughest leagues in the country. And he just gives me the Tatum Tuioti vibe of, as a true freshman, of like, hey, obviously the lines are in different places where Dutch doesn't have to play right away unless he's good enough. But kind of came in under the radar a little bit, really, you know, very skilled, getting his body now up to the level of college athletics. Because remember, Tatum apparently showed up at like 212 pounds. Now he's like 270 pounds or something.
263 on the roster, yeah.
And so I just get, I get some, with Dutch Horsick, I get some Tatum vibes of like, hey, no one's really talking about this guy. Coaches keep mentioning his name a little bit. He probably isn't going to be more than just a couple snaps per game, but because of the redshirt rule now, like, we might see him on special teams. We might see him find his way onto the field five times a game, but he plays in 12 games. I don't know. I think those are the guys that we're banking on. And I've got a lot of confidence that those guys, all a handful of them, show up.
You're right that the rotation can expand because it's now like a true meritocracy where you take out the redshirt rule. So just the best players play. There's no caveats. And to your point about those edge players being incorporated, I think I think you're right. Because Oregon uses a jack and they use a big end essentially. And the jack is Tatum. The big end is Mateo. It sounds like Breland, it sounds like Tank Jones and Rushing are all kind of fitting in at that big end spot. And it sounds like Nasir Wyatt is kind of Tatum's primary backup, right? Mm-hmm. That's sort of the sense I get. And if they are going to go three deep at each position, to your point, that opens the door for a Blue Dantzler. It opens the door for a Dutch Horsick. And Horsick is somebody who, when I had Cam Aragi on the pod last month to talk about his position group, he raved about him and his commitment to his craft and how much he cared. The fact that he came from a program that got him ready and he worked his butt off and he kind of, you know, he threw out like he might only be a three-star. The other guys are rated differently, but he's just as capable and is just as committed as those guys are. So I'm kind of with you. Yeah. I mean, I think between Dantzler and Horsick, one of those guys will pop. And I mean, I asked Cam about, like, could you see six or eight edge guys play? And he said there's no cap on it. It was kind of non-committal, didn't throw out a number, but I'm kind of anticipating, you know, in games where I don't even think it's games where it becomes a blow. I think it's games just play, you know, plain and simple, they're going to be playing three guys at each of these spots. And we've established kind of who some of those names are going to be. And now it's just a matter of seeing who really emerges there. But I think it's worth letting fans kind of into the fact that the redshirt's no longer around here. And I do think that will allow, especially in a 15-game season, 16-game season, depending upon how far they go, there's value in playing more players. And I think that's something that they're very keen on. And the fact that there sounds like there's a lot of players developing behind the scenes certainly is encouraging to that. So, but we probably went a little long on the segment, Matt, but I think that probably speaks to just how excited we are about some of these names.
All right, let's go to the next part of the show here. Things or what do we make about what's come out so far of the first scrimmage? Dan Lanning talked a little bit about balls on the ground. What we originally thought was kind of a good showing by quarterbacks, saying there was only one interception and it was a tipped ball, which doesn't necessarily fall on the quarterback's hands. Turned out to be Lanning said there was a lot more there, though, that could have been handled better, you know, better confidence under command, you know, what have you. Is that him just being the general, you know, we want more? Special teams did sound like they weren't up to par, maybe for the first scrimmage. Players wanting to run, like, is that self-punishment? Is that just like, hey, like, this group's different, we're committed to being more? What did we make of the scrimmage comments from Dan on Saturday right off after, and then Tuesday when we got with him for film review as well?
I think they had a really good scrimmage is what I think. And then I think they had a really good practice on Monday. And I think that might have been why Dan was in a really good mood on Tuesday. Because he sat down and he was like, what do you guys want to talk about? Like, there was no,
that's not normal.
That was the first time we'd ever done that. And then of course somebody asked about the polls and he got not happy about that for a second, but thought, hell no. Okay, good. Good question. We got a good answer to that. I mean, now I'm reading body language as if that is deterministic of what took place a couple of days earlier at the scrimmage. But I think when you talk to everybody in the totality of what we've heard, I think they had a good first scrimmage. And I think there's a level of confidence that, like, this is a great place to start. Like, the building block is, you know, where this goes is kind of anyone's best guess, but where it's starting is maybe a little ahead of where it's been in the past. And, you know, the special teams thing that caught my attention. I think we brought it up even again earlier this week in the show, because there's a question specifically about special teams. Like, I'm still a little bit wary about where this is going to be, just because these are younger players. I like that Joe Lorick has confidence in kind of coming out and naming who the guys are going to be. Be great if there was better performance behind the scenes. It sounds like maybe it wasn't great, and that can be concerning when there's so many new players to break in. But, you know, I thought the fact that Dan came out and said that the defense has been attacking the ball better than any of the defenses previous to that, and that showed up in the scrimmage, was encouraging. I think the fact that, you know, he mentioned that the quarterbacks, I know that there was one turnover, but, you know, like, it was on a batted ball, and maybe there were some kind of issues here and there, but it sounded like the quarterbacks had a pretty clean day. I know there were some explosive plays based upon some things we've heard. So I'm coming out of this thinking that they're in a pretty good spot, and that there's some confidence internally about kind of what this means for where they're at. And to your point about the running afterwards, like, that sounded, I think you're right, that sounds a little different, right? You know, and I think it was a quote, I can't remember which one, it's a Dan Lanning quote that was attributed to him by another member of the staff. And it was something like, great is on the other side of hard.
Yes.
I think that's this. It sounds like this team's embraced that part of just like, we're going to have to work our butts off to get to where we want to go. And we know we're talented enough to get there. And really the only obstacle for that is ourselves. And so I think the fact that you come out of a full scrimmage and those guys, I'm sure, worked their asses off, and they're still like, more. I think that's a really good sign for where this team is at from a culture perspective.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat that I think this team recognizes kind of what they could become if they don't let complacency creep into fall camp and they don't let guys being satisfied for what they put out on the field at all times, and instead just find that extra rep, find that extra, you know, sprint that you need to give to push yourself, to which then pushes your teammates because they see you doing it, and so now they've got to do it, and all of that. And I think, you know, this is where we're at in terms of fall camp, reading body language,
I know,
all of that. But we've seen Dan Lanning come off of scrimmage practices and have zero desire to talk about the scrimmage and be extremely short worded and he's great at word salad. This was not the case Saturday nor Tuesday. he felt different. He sounded different. I think he knows he's got a really good team. And now it's, to steal a quote from one of his mentors, prevent the rat poison from finding its way into the program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think I totally agree. There's a sense for my that I'm coming from of like, I think he knows what they've got and he's pretty excited about it. And he just seems to be a little bit more of an open book in certain topics. And I think he knows he doesn't have to protect quite as much, even though there are certain things he's clearly quite protective of, as we learned last week. Is there anything we're curious on for the second scrimmage, which is there's a second and final scrimmage this Saturday. We should note, obviously we're not allowed in practice, but we'll get Dan again afterwards. Is there anything we're kind of keeping our eye out for, or we're curious for going into that?
I would love to know kind of how deep of a pool of players they have up front along the offensive line protecting Dante Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe to even make it more broader, which may answer this question of, in the second scrimmage, do you still just completely mishmash your units together to see who works? Or is this starting to feel out like we're not making a first team, but we think these seven guys are kind of in play to be one of the five guys that takes the first snap against Boise. So we're going to rotate these five guys together, or these seven guys together. And we think there's a big drop off after that. So we're going to take the next six on the offensive line. And these are kind of the guys we think are the second tier guys. So they're going to play together just to see if any one of them kind of emerges above the group to elevate them up a level or drop a level in that instance. I think that's kind of where I would be at of how much are you mix matching just randomness, and how much are you now strategically going like, hey, this guy's probably going to play. Let's see if he can be a starter.
Yeah, no, I like that. That's something we will have no knowledge of coming out of the scrimmage, but I like where your head's at, Matt, because it's not built into our show notes here. That's my biggest point of curiosity right now through camp is like, what's really going on with the offensive line? And what does this look like? I'm not even trying to say it's going to be bad. I just don't have a great sense from these interviews and how guarded they've been, you know, cause I mentioned Dan was great post scrimmage on Saturday. I got called on with the first question, which I didn't necessarily want it to be the first question, but I was like, early assessments on the offensive line. And his response was no early assessments on the offensive line. So like not that he's necessarily doesn't want, maybe he just didn't like the way I worded the question or didn't want to start there, but that's the point I just have a lot of interest in, of like, what's really going on there? Who, to your point, like, are they trying to get their best five on the field right now on Saturday as a, you know, 2 weeks ahead of the season? Is that something that they'll try to incorporate, you know, just in the lead up to the game in that first week? Who's in that group? I mean, all these things, there's a lot of questions there. And considering it's a group that I think kind of, you know, is going to be foundational to the success of the season, it would be great to have a little bit more answers there. But I don't know if we're going to get them come out of Saturday either.
All right, we're going to end the show with this discussion. We saw it's award season, right? During fall camp, we see these all come play out. Guys get named to awards, it feels like every day. The Biletnikoff Award, which is presented by the Tallahassee Quarterback Club Foundation, recognizes the most outstanding FBS receiver regardless of position. So because today's day and age of football has just changed so much, you know, tight ends are included in this. You probably will find a running back here or there on this list as well. Like a Byron Marshall would be someone from years past that would be on this list as running back.
Or like a D'Anthony.
Yeah, so D'Anthony. They released their watch list, and it's recognizing the most outstanding receiver regardless of position in college football at the FBS level. Two Ducks made the list. That's not a surprise whatsoever. Jamari Johnson's one of those two players who made the list. That's not a surprise whatsoever. I mean, considering he's a first-round draft pick potential guy this season, could have gone pro last year. Makes total sense. This player that did get mentioned is worthy of being included. I think it's surprising to us that he is the one over a couple other names, and these other names did not get included. Iverson Hooks made the Biletnikoff watch list, but Evan Stewart, DeCoria Moore, and Jeremiah McClellan all did not. That in of itself, to me, is a little surprising because, Eric, we make the depth chart today, and it's a little bit of a guess, but based off of spring game performance, based off of last season's performance, Iverson Hooks is not in the starting lineup. And the three guys that I mentioned who aren't on the list, I think are probably the three most likely guys to be in the starting lineup.
Yeah, cosign. That's how I feel. And now I'm wondering if we've got this wrong. These award watch lists, which are not voted on by coaches, which are voted on by members of media and people in that Tallahassee quarterbacks club. I don't have maybe a great sense of what's happening at Oregon fall camp, or don't have a great sense of like what's actually good. It's like, I feel like this is more of a looking back at what happened last season as opposed to a predictive award. And if I was looking at Oregon's roster, I would say, well, Jamari Johnson might be the best tight end in the country. He should be on there. And if we're only doing two players, because no school had more than two on this list, which I noted, because I think Oregon could have three or four or five guys if you really, really wanted to just be kind of wide, cast a wide net here, you could. But if you're only going to do two, Iverson Hooks did have 900 something yards, seven touchdowns last year at UAB. Like, that's the more impressive statistical breakdown. But it's also kind of ignoring the context that Jeremiah McClellan is the top returning receiver, regardless of position. He had more receiving yards last year than Jamari did. And that Evan Stewart and DeCorian Moore are, I think, higher profile players, certainly higher recruiting rankings, and players that have been productive, right? And injuries got in the way. And I think maybe that's sort of clouding some of this messaging. And frankly, kind of aligns with what I was talking about earlier in the year, where I was saying, I think DeCorian Moore could be a Biletnikoff caliber, player. I think we all think Jeremiah Smith's probably going to win this award. So it's kind of a moot point anyway to talk this out, but like, we already know who's going to win, but like, DeCorian could be a finalist or in the conversation, throughout the season, but because he was hurt last year, if you look at the stats and kind of don't think of that throw, it's like, well, he only had 480 yards or whatever ended up being. It's, maybe that kind of costs him a little cachet. And I think that's kind of what this is representative of, is Evan Stewart didn't play at all last year. They're probably thinking, well,
that one's the most understandable. He didn't play last year. Let's see what he does.
Exactly. Well, he's not going to be the best receiver in the country. He came off injury. And with DeCorian, he didn't even have 500 yards last year, even though he was injured for, the entire month of November. And I don't know if he was even close to 100% by the time he came back in December and January. So, I guess I can kind of understand it if you're just broadly looking at Oregon's roster and going, we got to pick two guys. One's going to be this really dynamic tight end everyone's excited about. And the other guy was, I guess, just the one who had really good production last year. But I think it's kind of missing what's going to actually take place here, which is, we think these outside receivers are so dynamic that one of them is going to be, maybe one, two, or three of them are going to be more productive players than Iverson Hooks this year. And I that's why this was a surprise to me. I got a couple of friends text me, like, did you see this? Like, they don't have DeCorian or Jeremiah or Evan on here, but they have Iverson Hooks. And I was kind of like, wow, that is a bit of a shock to me too. So I think mostly it's just a byproduct of past production though.
I think maybe the deep peel back the layer underlying theme here is Oregon's receiver room is absolutely stacked, man. Like if we're sitting here saying the fourth, and quite honestly, Eric, maybe this is another debate we need to have. Who has a better year from a production standpoint, Iverson Hooks or a Jalen Lott? What's more likely? I don't know that answer.
There's a lot of Jalen Lott hype building. I think he's had a really good fall camp. It's kind of a shame he wasn't here in spring to kind of get that extra stuff, that extra step and extra development. But boy, you're right. Like, and that's where you go. Legitimately, there's one football.
Yep.
There's these five receivers we just talked about. Oh yeah. By the way, Gatlin Bear can run 10-1 in the 100, and he's 6'2", 205 apparently. There's only one football. There's those six names I just threw out, and we can condense it to four or five, whatever we want. And then there's also Jamari Johnson, and then De'Aaron Hill Jr. What's been the talk in this camp about him? He's going to be more involved in the passing game.
Yeah.
So This is probably the case for like Oregon's not going to have somebody who wins this award, also because Jeremiah Smith's playing football this year. But it's just because I don't know what the likelihood someone puts up like 1,000-yard season, and you know, even maybe multiple 800-yard seasons this year in terms of this whole group, because there's just a lot of dudes and there's only one football. And as good as Dante Moore is at distributing that football, unless he's throwing for 500 or 600 yards per game, like not all these guys can have 100-yard games regularly. So that part's going to be really fascinating. And like, I guess about here's where I think we can end this segment in the show. Who do we think would be most likely of being a finalist or a semifinalist in the Biletnikoff of all the names listed? We'll include Jamari, all the pass catchers. Like, who do we think is most likely at the end of the year or close to the end of the year to still be included in this discussion?
That's a really good question. I will probably pick Jamari Johnson.
It's probably the safest pick.
What about you?
I think Evan. I think I'm buying the Evan Stewart hype. DeCorian would have been my pick before fall camp. And then we heard so much positive Evan stuff, and there's been frankly not a lot of DeCorian stuff, and then some things behind the scenes. It sounds like that maybe he had a tough summer with some things that took place, and you can kind of see evidence of that in some of the photos from Media Day that are available. I think of the receivers, I think he's going to be the alpha this year. I think that's how it's going to play out. Year five is going to be a big year for Evan Stewart. That's what I'm predicting.
And I think the point we've made is I picked Jamari, totally understandable. You picked Evan, totally understandable, totally plausible. We could have picked DeCorian, and that would have been totally plausible. And totally. We probably could have picked Jeremiah McClellan, and that also would have been totally plausible. And I think that's the point we're trying to make here is there really wasn't a clear-cut receiver. If you had to pick one on this team to make this Biletnikoff award, and it's – look, we're making a big deal about a Biletnikoff preseason watch list, but that's what we do in August, right? When we don't get to watch practice, we don't get to see what we're doing for who we're covering, we break stuff down like this. That's where we're at. But the point is
– yeah.
They're loaded at the receiver position, maybe as loaded as they've ever been. And there are so many options that you could have picked to make this award. They probably picked the one that's the least likely, in my opinion. And that's not a shot at Iverson Hooks. I think that's just a reality of how loaded and talented this room is, that there might not be a guy that has a 75 catch, 1,200 yard, 13 touchdown type season for the Ducks in 2026, because as you put it, there's one ball and there's so many mouths to feed, and they don't need to force feed the ball like they did to Troy Franklin and Tez Johnson in 2023, because they have so much depth. All right. Thanks for watching on YouTube and listening wherever you get your podcasts. For the fans of this podcast, whether you're on YouTube or wherever you get your shows from an audio perspective, we got a special treat. Use the promo code DUCKS60. If you're on YouTube, it's the bottom of your screen on the right to get 60% off an annual subscription to DuckTerritory.com, where you will get the latest recruiting ranking news, transfer portal updates, and wall-to-wall coverage of Oregon athletics here on the Odds and Novels podcast, which is part of DuckTerritory.com on 24/7 sports. So if you enjoy the show and you enjoy this podcast, the best way to support it is by subscribing to DuckTerritory.com, and we can get you a 60% off annual membership to DuckTerritory.com today by using promo code DUCK60 when you sign up. But until the next one, you've been listening to the Odds and Novels podcast.
Talk to you later, folks.
From executive producer Kim Kardashian and the producers of Love Island USA,
baseball and Scottsdale go hand in hand,
comes a new series about the parents behind elite youth baseball.
What was that?
We don't even know what's about to come.
Team Moms Baseball, September 24th on Paramount+.